This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Reaction in New Hampshire continues to President Trump's weekend immigration order. U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen called it un-American. Governor Sununu, speaking with NH1, disagreed.
I definitely don't believe it's un-American. I think that's a very unfair misrepresentation. This is about strengthening our immigration policy, strengthening the processes that we currently use to vet the refugees and immigrants that are going to be coming to the country.
Other Granite State reaction, Attorney General Joe Foster, who accused the order of violating principles that are fundamental to our democracy. In Manchester, two leading figures also spoke out. The Chief of Police, Nick Willard, criticized the AG for criticizing President Trump, while Mayor Ted Gatsis said he supports stronger vetting, but also that the order was done too hastily and has created, the mayor said, chaos and confusion. Meanwhile, in the legislature, the president's supporters said the whole backlash is overblown and that a temporary halt is worth it for the sake of public safety. Today in The Exchange, we're taking the pulse of the Granite State on this immigration order. It's part of NPR and NHPR's coverage of the first 100 days at the White House and the State House. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Now we're going to hear from lots of people this hour with all kinds of perspectives. Our guest in studio for the hour is Erin Corcoran. She's a professor at UNH School of Law. She specializes in immigration law. And Erin, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura, for having me.
Well, what does the Constitution say, Erin, about immigration? Who has the power to make the decisions?
I mean, actually, the Constitution doesn't say much about immigration.
Really?
There's a couple of different clauses, like the Naturalization Clause, the Migration and Importation Clause. But generally, the courts have held piecing together different clauses within the Constitution gives both Congress and the executive branch sort of what we refer to as sort of plenary power over immigration, that the political branches get to decide who gets to come and who gets to stay. And the courts generally leave those decisions up to them. There are, at certain times, due process protections for immigrants that are in the immigration system, and the courts will come to task and hold agencies accountable for that. But generally speaking, the Constitution doesn't say much about immigration.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so how broad is the president's authority to shape immigration, Erin?
Well, under the Immigration and Nationality Act, passed by Congress in 1952 and subsequently amended, the president has a lot of latitude, even under the statute itself, broad discretion to decide who can come and who can stay, the ability to decide certain people are what we would refer to as inadmissible, not allowed to come. And then in addition to the Congress giving the president authority, he also has authority inherently as the executive. And we've seen several different administrations over time exercise both the statutory authority and the executive branch authority over immigration.
So was this done by executive order?
Yes.
Okay. So this is not unusual, right? I mean, other presidents have used executive orders to shape who can come in and who can't.
That is correct. I mean, the only thing that I would say that is somewhat different about it is that it's much more broad, and it isn't necessarily reacting to a specific incident or a specific crisis at hand. In the past, when you've seen presidents such as President Clinton in the 90s, when we had a Haitian refugee crisis, he used his authority over that particular crisis. After 9/11, President Bush used his executive authority to halt the refugee program, to require registration of men from certain countries. But again, in those situations, generally speaking, there was a reaction to something that had happened. And it wasn't as broad as this particular executive order.
So it more focused, these past executive orders by past presidents from Clinton to Bush to Obama also,
right,
were more focused on specific threats, one country, and didn't last very long. That's the difference.
That's correct. I mean, the other thing I would say is that those executive orders were also done with consultation with the agencies who are going to be charged with implementing them. And so there was a sense of sort of what the bandwidth of the agencies were, how they would be applied, and what steps needed to be taken to make sure that it happened in a smooth and transparent fashion.
I see. So there wasn't the usual outreach to agencies where everybody can say, okay, this is the deal, everybody on board, everybody know what they need to do. It happened very, very suddenly. In fact, that was the criticism that a lot of people have had, including Mayor Ted Gatzis. The Trump people have said, Aaron, you know, look, why would we signal to our enemies, you know, that this is what we're going to do?
Well, I mean, I think talking to people within the agency who have to implement the order isn't talking to our enemies, it's talking to our allies. I mean, just to give you an example, the order prohibits the travel of nationals from 7 different countries, including immigrants and non-immigrants. The Department of Homeland Security initially interpreted that as meaning people who had green cards from those countries, would they be allowed to come in? Their reading of that was, yes, we'll allow them to come in. They have a different status, and under immigration law, legal permanent residents are accorded additional protections than other non-citizens. And then the administration said, no, we want you to not allow green card holders to come in. And then just recently, as of yesterday, the administration was saying, no, in fact, DHS, your interpretation of the order is correct. So, you know, and that could have been resolved had they discussed before the order was actually executed.
So it's actually kind of hard for the average Joe or Jane border control agent at Logan Airport or wherever to figure out who to let in and who to keep out.
That's correct. I think there's been a lot of confusion at the various airports.
The exchange number for you to join us as we look at Granite State reaction to this immigration order is 1-800-892-6477. And this hour, we're going to hear from an array of New Hampshire voices, politicians who feel this will make the state safer, immigrants who worry about their families, colleges who welcome foreign students. Let's hear from you. Your questions, comments are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So here's something, Aaron, and again, drawing on your expertise as an immigration law specialist. What about courts? Who has the final say if somebody challenges this new policy and the judge agrees with them?
I mean, the courts have the final say over sort of how the law and the Constitution should be interpreted. I mean, I imagine that these whatever the court decides will be will be appealed to the highest court. I imagine that these cases will make their way to the Supreme Court. But when the courts have gotten involved, when they've actually decided that the people who were bringing the lawsuits are the proper people to bring the lawsuits, that the issue is something that we call justiciable, that the courts have the authority to hear that case. When the courts make those decisions, they are binding on the executive and Congress. And so there have been instances when the courts have stepped in.
Okay, that's a civics 101. So just let's go through that slowly, because I think a lot of people would think, okay, the president, you know, he's the guy. Who cares about some judge that nobody's heard of?
So, I mean, the courts are the final arbiter of the Constitution. They get to decide what it says, what does it mean. And so to the extent that the president is saying, I have this authority to do that under the Constitution, the courts can also decide whether or not that his interpretation is correct.
Do you think that the average person, again, working at the border, working at an airport, understands that?
I mean, I think they do. Abstractly, but when it comes to the day-to-day operations, they also understand that they work for the executive, and the president is the chief executive. And so he's their sort of final report up the chain of command.
Well, and on these legal questions we've been talking about, Aaron, Dennis on Facebook sent us this. U.S. Code 1182, inadmissible aliens, suspension of entry or imposition of restrictions by the president. And again, thank you, Dennis, for this. It says, whenever the president finds that the entry of any aliens or any class of aliens into the U.S. would be detrimental to the interests of the U.S., he may, by proclamation and for such period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens as immigrants or non-immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions he may deem to be appropriate. Again, that was sent to us by Dennis on Facebook. So he seems to be saying what you just said, Aaron, which is the you know, people may like it or not, but the president has the right to do this.
Right. It's also INA 212F. The president's executive order cites to it. It's what President Obama used when he suspended the refugee program temporarily based on the San Bernardino shootings. It's definitely that broad statutory authority I mentioned earlier that Congress has given the president on the authority to decide who gets to come and who gets to stay.
So President Obama did suspend the refugee program, not a broad immigration group, but the refugee program.
Not the entire refugee program. Mm-hmm. A very discrete group of people who were coming from countries where there was high terrorism and it was for a temporary period of time to increased vetting and security measures. So he didn't completely bring the refugee resettlement program to a halt.
Again, this gets back to what you've said before, which is it isn't that this is outside of what the president can do. What's different is the scope and the breadth.
Right.
All right. Let's take some calls. Aaron, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Janice is in Exeter. Hi, Janice. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a question or something, a thought that maybe people could add to. We already have 14 agencies in place in the vetting process. And if President Trump wants to increase the process and add to the process of vetting, what else is he thinking about doing to ensure that people are properly vetted? And we already have 14 agencies that are used to vet, and people already have to wait years. So I'm wondering what possibly could be added to enhance the vetting process.
Okay.
Any thoughts about that?
Janice, thank you so much. Go ahead, Aaron. Any thoughts there?
Sure. I mean, I think Janice is right with respect to the refugee admission program. It's the program that is the most highly vetted. Individuals are vetted overseas. And she's right. Interagency, anywhere from Interpol to FBI, CIA. I think it's a good question. It may be that there's going to be more personal interviews or more investigation into family backgrounds. There's lots of different ways in which, in addition to running people's biometrics through a database, you could imagine people being deployed to interview families on the ground to see if there's terrorist ties. It would be incredibly cumbersome and costly, but it could be more akin to like an individual going through a security clearance here in the United States.
Well, and I have heard other people say what you say many times, Aaron, that refugees are screened, vetted for years, that the holes or the areas where vetting could be strengthened is more in tourism visas, business visas, student visas.
Right. If you wanted to find the path of least resistance to get into the United States, it would not be through the Refugee Resettlement Program.
All right. Janice, thank you for that call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We're going to go now to Reza Jalili. He came to the U.S. from Iran in 1975. He's a professor of economics at New England College. Reza's been working for more than 10 years to help his brother's family emigrate to the U.S. They were due to fly here on January 29th, but were not allowed to board the plane. Reza, I know this has been a stressful time for you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. Good morning.
Good morning. So, as I said, you've been working for more than a decade to get your brother's family here.
Yes.
What takes so long?
I really don't know, because, my brother's priority is not high in the list, because he is an adult son, married of my mom. The petitioner was my mother, so who is a U.S. citizen. So the priority is much lower than if you were spouse of somebody or some other status.
So
that's why it took so long.
So what have they been doing for the past decade, Reza, to get to this goal?
We filed the petition in 2004, actually, but it was basically in line, and 2012 the actual thing started, the actual process, because by then it was, until then it was just online. They're both physicians. They were working. They're still working. They're actually not in the past few days, because they basically resigned from their positions. Now they're back sitting at home.
So they have resigned their positions as doctors. They have sold their house. They've said goodbye to all their friends. And then they get stuck at the airport. What do they do?
Yeah. Well, they haven't sold the house yet, but, you know, that was in the works. But, yeah, everything else basically settled down. And, you know, everything was in their luggage. And they went there, and even they accepted their luggage at first, but then they pulled it back because they said, you're going to be stuck in Frankfurt because the connecting flight was Frankfurt. And that's why they didn't board them. And today I was talking to my brother. He checked with 5 different airlines, and all of them saying the same thing. And my brother's situation is so peculiar because he already has the immigrant visa on his passport. And nonetheless, they do not let him, because they want actual physical green card.
So he has the immigrant visa on his passport, but not the green card.
Yeah, he has an immigrant visa. Well, yeah, because it's at the border when they give them a sealed envelope, mm-hmm. which he has. When they get to the border, they give it to the border official, immigration officer, and then they process it. I don't know how they process it then, and then they mail the actual green card to his permanent address in the U.S. So he has everything, and I even consulted an immigration lawyer. I don't know the accuracy of it, but based on him, he said he is considered to be a permanent resident because he already has the ID visa on his passport. And he has alien number. He already has the alien number, which is a green card number.
Well, and Reza, I hear your frustration. I wonder, you know, again, I'm struck by how long it even took him and his family to get to this point. What was that vetting process like? I mean, that's the word that keeps coming up. Vetting needs to be stronger. So just describe the vetting that your brother and his family went through.
Okay, he has been through, first of all, he had to get from, you know, Iranian police, he had to get the, you know, the fact that he has no criminal record. That's one. Then he had to go through the process, and I think the State Department, Department of Homeland Security, and then on the last piece, because it was March 15 when he had his interview, the final interview in Turkey and medical exam, and then it took until October 27th. So that means at that time they told him you have to go through the FBI process. So from March 15 to October 27th, presumably FBI was checking him, and then they gave him the visa. And the unfortunate thing is the visa expires on April 18th, which is going to be within the 90 days that the administration imposed, so he's going to lose everything.
Oh, my goodness, after all that work. So checked out by the Iranian police, the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI. And from what I understand, Reza, some of that had to happen in Turkey, right? So he had to travel from Iran to Turkey because...
Yeah, he had to go... Yeah, his physical interview was in Turkey, yes.
So now what, Reza? I mean, yeah, go ahead.
I don't know. I really don't know. I was talking to him about half an hour ago, and he said, so what am I supposed to do? I said, well, I don't know. You know, the sad part is he was telling me over and over and over before that I should come before the new administration comes. I said, no, the United States is governed by laws, by rule of law, and nobody can take away your right. This is your right. You already have it. But now, all I have to say is that I'm embarrassed because I told him things that apparently was not true.
Well, Reza, we'll check back in with you as this story unfolds.
Sure thing.
Okay.
Sure thing.
Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll talk again.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
That's Reza Jalili. Again, he's an American citizen, came to the U.S. from Iran in the 70s, and has been trying desperately, as we heard, to get his brother's family in the U.S., both of whom are doctors. Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the Granite State reacts to President Trump's immigration order. We're hearing a variety of views this hour in The Exchange. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to share your thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guest for the hour is Erin Corcoran, professor at UNH School of Law. She specializes in immigration. One more time, that number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. And Erin, let's go to our listeners. And Chris is in Nashua. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning. Go ahead.
I have 2 points. Trump's message that every immigrant is a latent terrorist who will never assimilate and will inevitably turn against the U.S. is just another incarnation of that same old xenophobic refrain. We have well over 2 centuries of proof that America does an excellent job of assimilating immigrants. Huge ethnic ghettos and religious ghettos always empty out as their population mainstreams into society. So whether it was the Catholics or the Irish or whatever, we see that these people, you know, become upstanding citizens. You know, that's the first point. The second point is, like many issues that Trump talks about, I feel like he wants the issue more than he wants the truth, and he does this to manipulate a lot of uninformed people with fear. And I personally care, you know, since you asked about, you know, what do we care about, I personally care a lot more about the anti-government crazies and the so-called sovereign citizens and white racists who target police officers, government officials, and minorities in order to bring about their version of a purer republic.
Well, Chris, thank you for the call, and he raises the history of immigration in this country, and I wonder how far back you want to go with that, Erin. I mean, again, your specialty is law, not immigration history, but he's right. There have been attempts in the past to keep out certain groups.
I mean, I think you can go back all the way and to the Chinese Exclusion Act, 1800s, which basically was a statute that was passed by Congress that did not allow people coming from China to enter, and in fact, people who were here were deported, and the Supreme Court upheld that statute.
Well, Chris, thank you for the call. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. An email came in from Rob. He says, this seems like Chicken Little. The sky is falling to me. Rob says, from what I understand, this is a temporary ban while we look into and shore up our vetting policies with regard to these nations, not permanent. This end of the world, Rob says, reaction is merely politics. Other presidents have made similar, not identical, orders in the past. Rob says nobody said boo when President Obama temporarily banned a limited amount of visas from Iraq in 2011 for 6 months. Rob concludes by saying, are we going to protest everything the new president does for the next 4 years? He says, I, for one, am getting weary of it already. He's just trying to keep us safe. Rob, thank you for that email. And just remind us, Erin, if you could, of that limited ban from President Obama in 2011. There was an issue in Kentucky, some people from Iraq posing as refugees and ended up having terrorist ambitions.
Right. So relying on that same statutory authority that you cited earlier, President Obama temporarily suspended the program for one particular country for a limited time period and to increase vetting, but did not suspend it indefinitely. For a particular country.
And it was just targeted to that incident,
yes,
that
exactly.
Population, not 7 countries,
right,
such as are included in this ban.
Right. And with respect to the refugee program that was been temporarily suspended for 120 days, the Syrian ban is permanent and until it becomes authorized by the president to reopen. So,
well, and a couple of our listeners have mentioned politics. Chris, you know, clearly criticizing the president and his supporters. Rob saying, are we going to protest everything the new president does for the next 4 years? You know, not that long ago, New Hampshire Democratic Governor Maggie Hassan also called for a, quote, pause in immigration on Syrian refugees. And then she was asked about this recently. You know, why did you call for that pause then? And now you're saying what President Trump is doing is bad. Let's hear.
Well, what I called for was a temporary pause to ensure that we could make sure our vetting system was as strong as possible. I think we can always be working to make all of our vetting systems for all entryways to this country stronger, but we have to do it in a way that is consistent with our American values.
All right. Again, that sound courtesy of NH1. Governor Hassan explaining her earlier call for a pause in immigration from Syrian refugees. Aaron, I want to bring another voice into our conversation. With us on the phone right now is Fred Doucette, Republican representative from Salem, assistant majority leader. He was co-chair of Donald Trump's campaign in New Hampshire. And Representative Doucette, nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be with you.
Well, you're a retired firefighter, so clearly concerned about public safety. How much do you think this order makes Americans safer, Representative Doucette?
Oh, I think it's a start. I think, in my estimation, they're probably going to end up, and I'm just guessing, I have no intimate knowledge, but I think they're going to add more countries to it. And, you know, it's not a full and complete ban, which a lot of people are talking about. It's a 90-day moratorium on those specific countries. And, you know, there should be other countries added to that, in my estimation.
What countries do you think should be added, Representative Doucette?
Oh, obviously Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Pakistan.
You have some friends that you lost on 9/11, as I understand, Representative Doucette, and I'm really, really sorry to hear that. How does that shape your view?
Oh, I appreciate that. One of my dearest childhood friends, the mother of my goddaughter, actually lost her mom on Flight 175, the second plane that hit the towers. Mm. And being a firefighter, I lost 343 brothers and on, people I went to school with. I think that plays into some of my thought processes, but, you know, the fact remains, this isn't a secret. President Trump spoke during the campaign that he was going to put American lives before anybody else's lives. So this should come as no surprise to anybody that he's moving the way he's moving.
It sounds like, given your experience with 9/11, you would put Saudi Arabia on that list.
Absolutely.
Many commentators, again, talking about the countries, Representative Doucette, many people, including Senator Shaheen just this morning on NHPR, have pointed to the many Iraqis who helped the U.S. during the Iraq War, those Iraqis fighting side by side with Americans right now against ISIS. Senator Shaheen sent the Secretary of Defense a letter saying, you know, please intervene on behalf of these Iraqis who provided essential support to American forces. Was targeting Iraq a mistake, given that they're a key component of the fight against ISIS, given that some of them really helped Americans during the Iraq War?
Not necessarily, because if they put the correct vetting procedures in place, we can find those people that were such great helps to us and vet them through. I think this is going to be a learning process. There's going to be a little bump in the road here, a little inconvenience for a number of individuals. But short of that, I don't see a big issue.
Mayor Gatsis, the mayor of Manchester, had a statement on President Trump's executive order saying a lot of what you're saying, Representative Doucette. You know, I support controlling our borders, strengthening the vetting process, imperative for the safety of our country and our community. But he did say it must be implemented fairly and with clarity of due process and rules. He says he's concerned with the haste with which this order was implemented and the resulting chaos and confusion. Again, this is from Mayor Ted Gatsis. What do you think? Not so much clearly you're on board with the thought behind this, but what do you think about the implementation, Representative Doucette?
Well, I think the sooner the better. The president got right to work, and I would challenge the fact the chaos is in that the people that are coming out to protest, you know, the hundreds of people blocking up. I heard a story this morning, a friend that was coming back from Europe that got tied up because of a certain Massachusetts senator's rally at Logan Airport. You know, I think that the chaos is, you know, the opposition mucking up the works. I mean, you heard the numbers over from Sean Spicer, 325,000 came in and they, you know, detained 109. So what is the impact really?
So agreeing with
for a few hours.
Agreeing with our earlier emailer who said, you know, a lot of this is the sky is falling. Again, that's an email from Rob. Two more quick questions for you, Representative Doucette, and then I think you have to go back into a meeting with the governor, so I really appreciate your time. As you know, New Hampshire businesses, employers have been struggling to find skilled workers to fill jobs, including H-1B visa workers. We've talked a ton about that on this program. How do you think this immigration order might affect that piece of the puzzle, New Hampshire's so-called demographic problem?
I don't know that it's going to have that large of an impact. I think that at least I assume that in our state, the majority of the immigrant workers are vetted through and are in the country legally. We don't seem to have the issues southern states have relative to the Mexican border. So I don't know that it'll have that big an impact.
And last question for you, please, Representative Doucette. You're an elected official, as I said, from Salem. What's your message to foreigners and especially Muslims in your community?
Well, I'll tell you, I served in the Navy and I served with Muslims, and I personally, they're some of the most wonderful people in the world. But there are people who want to bring harm to us. And all I would ask is be patient. Be patient with what we have to go through to straighten out a broken system of allowing people to immigrate legally. Just be patient. We'll get through this time.
Representative Doucette, we know you have to go. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
That's Representative Fred Doucette, Republican representative from Salem, assistant majority leader. He was co-chair of Donald Trump's campaign here in New Hampshire. Again, the exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Aaron, lots of reaction from our listeners that I want to go to, but a quick question for you, please. You know, Fred Doucette said something that actually is a bipartisan sentiment that we heard on the campaign trail this past year. The immigration system is broken. Is it really broken? What's your thought on that, given, you know, you're somebody who studies this every day?
I do think it's broken. I mean, I think it's been put to cobble together over time with disparate interests. We often compare the immigration statutes and its complexity and implementation to the tax code. And for the same reasons, different interests have come into play. I don't think the current visa numbers meet worker needs and the reality of sort of what our country and like the representative and you were discussing, the state's need for workforce. And so I do think there's a need to have a comprehensive overhaul of the immigration statute.
And everybody says that, and yet we never seem to get there. This is more of a political question, so maybe it's not fair, but everybody says we need a comprehensive overhaul. Nobody can agree on what that means. So instead, we see presidents like Bush, Obama, Trump just doing it by these executive orders.
Right. I mean, the last time we saw comprehensive immigration pass was in the Senate under Bush. However, the House ended up not being able to pass a mirror legislation. And so, right, very different interests have come into play. And I think it's become, in my experience in the last 5 or 6 years, become more polarizing and political than it was when the Senate passed it in 2006, I think. And it's become more of a divisive issue than it has historically been in Congress.
Well, again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter, NHPR Exchange. Here's an email from Karen who says, I've often heard the Trump administration did not want to, quote, broadcast their plans about the visa bans to possible terrorists, therefore limited their access. But haven't they done just that to the countries not on the list? Wouldn't those who want to do us harm residing in countries like Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, etc., now know the plan and travel here now before they're added to the list? Karen, thank you for that email. And as you heard, Representative Doucette thinks there are other countries that should be on the list, including Saudi Arabia. So thanks for jumping in there, Karen. Let's go back to our listeners. And Mohammed's joining us from Concord. Hi, Mohammed. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
I'm in Concord. Actually work with the American Army in Iraq about 3 years in the South Iraq. And I had the family in Iraq, stuck in Iraq. And how about my friend? About a million people, young people and men and women work in Iraq with American Army, support Army, like engineering or like interpreters. And this, about the other hand, if they, Mr. Trump, he liked to save America, everyone in the world he know. Which country make the Al-Qaeda and the ISIS? One country pay money, a lot of money, to push Al-Qaeda and help them. This country is Arabia Saudi. Who make the 9/11? Arabia Saudi. How about Arabia Saudi and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Egypt?
So don't blame Iraq, basically, Mohammed, is what you're saying.
Yeah, because in Iraq, work together with the American to the fighting the ISIS in Iraq now, in this time. The Iraqi help American to push ISIS out Iraq and push the area. I think that's not fair.
Well,
how about the people in Iraq now stuck?
Sure, and providing key support in the fight against ISIS. And, Mohammed, I think Iraq especially is getting a lot of attention, given that they are working hard to fight ISIS, given the support of many like you who helped the American military during the Iraq War. Senator Shaheen herself mentioned this morning on Morning Edition with Rick Ganley. Let's hear.
I think we would all agree that if there are ways that we can make our vetting process for refugees more effective, we want to do that, but this is not the way to do it. And I'm particularly concerned also because one of the groups of people that we are keeping out are those Iraqis who helped our men and women on the ground during the conflict in Iraq, the interpreters who are part of a special immigrant visa program who can come to the United States when their lives are threatened.
Well, and people like you, Mohammed, who helped on the ground, as you said. So thank you very much for that call. Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. And Aaron Corcoran, as we said earlier, Iran is also on the list. And we heard from Reza Jalili, his saga of trying to get his brother's family here for 10 years. His family seems to me to be that, you know, example that people on both sides of this argument often use, right? They, quote unquote, got in line, followed the rules. I mean, that's what people who support immigration reform always say. We want to support those people who get in line and follow the rules.
That's correct. And I think they also illustrate, again, why the immigration system is broken in the sense that the lines are so long and they're for so many years. I mean, he talked about 10 years of waiting. And so that can be a very protracted situation for people. And so one of the ideas about fixing the immigration system is shortening the lines for the people who do follow the rules and do exactly what they're supposed to do and pay the fees and go through the security and medical checks to come to this country.
Well, and talk about vetting. His family, as he told us, was vetted by the Iranian police, the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI. So they are all cleared to go. And then now they're stuck for a moment anyway, as some of our guests have been saying, temporarily. Let's go to Concord, and Merrill is joining us from there. Hi, Merrill. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
First of all, I should mention that many of my family came to this country as refugees from the Nazis, including my own father. He was very lucky and got here in 1938. Most of the others were the few who survived the Holocaust. And what's going on now is so painful to me, I can't even tell you. I could understand, although not agree, if a properly organized temporary ban were placed on issuing visas, but to apply a ban to people who already have visas in hand, like the family who's the brother of the gentleman who spoke earlier.
Reza Jalili's family, yeah.
And sometimes they go back and forth on this to green card holders. This is intolerable. That family waited not 10 years, but 12 years, according to what the gentleman said. And they've got the visa in hand. It's going to expire before the 90 days. They'll have to start all over again. I keep saying to myself, this is America. Sorry, that sounds a bit hysterical. Or at least it was until a couple weeks ago.
Well, Merrill, I'm going to cut you off there just to go into a short break, but thank you for chiming in today. The exchange number for you to join us, like Merrill and so many others have, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, battles over immigration and refugee status, the impact in the Granite State. It's part of NPR and NHPR's effort to look at the first 100 days of the White House and the State House. The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter @NHPR. exchange. Erin Corcoran is with me in studio, professor at UNH School of Law. She specializes in immigration, and we've been hearing from a number of people with a variety of views on this immigration ban. With us now is Paul LeBlanc. He is president of Southern New Hampshire University. He issued a strongly worded letter on this to his campus community recently. And Paul LeBlanc, welcome.
Thank you, Laura. It's good to be back with you.
Well, I'm not going to read the whole letter, but here's just a quote that I want to share with listeners and then ask you about it, Paul. You say, "When we read about the dark chapters in human history, we often ask ourselves, what would we have done? I believe this is one of those times when the question now is very real, and I ask my colleagues to consider how they want their story told when we someday look back at this day." That's pretty dramatic language, Paul. What are you trying to convey there?
I think this is a rather perilous time. I have a daughter who's a graduate student in history at Stanford, and she was at a panel she shared with me last night in which one of the faculty said, "This, not since the Civil War has the Republic faced a more perilous time." And that rings true to me.
Perilous in what way?
I think erosion of constitutional rights. I think a sort of sliding towards a kind of autocracy that The Atlantic magazine has a special edition coming out talking about how an autocracy happens. I think the really just sort of troubling sort of erosion of some basic American ethos. This is the country that's built on welcoming refugees and immigrants. And I also think just sort of bad thinking. I mean, there's no reason in the world to think that our vetting process for refugees isn't working. When people say, you know, when they defend the policy and say things like, you know, we just want to take a little bit of time to make it more rigorous, I always ask them, what does it look like now? Invariably, they can't answer the question.
Well, President Blanken, we have heard that the refugee vetting process is quite extensive, but for other types of visas, perhaps a little bit less so. So can you make a blanket statement like that for all types of immigrants?
Well, we're talking about refugee policy, the executive order on refugees specifically. So my statement about the vetting policy is specifically regarding that. And as you know, there are many, many steps in a very prolonged process. I think for student visas, I think it is certainly less rigorous, but the debate doesn't seem to be centering on the question of student visas or tourist visas. It's really centered on refugee repopulation.
The administration, Paul, has repeatedly said this is temporary, with the exception of Syrian refugees. And we've heard from a couple people this hour who say, you know, a lot of this is just, you know, political overreaction. So what do you think, Paul? I mean, are you overreacting a bit with that dark chapter language? This is temporary.
Yeah, so I think the language is really about, I think, a broader erosion of some basic American values. And you know, I've been sort of inundated with responses from parents and from students, and particularly international students. And many of them are quite fearful, so many of our international students. And we're advising them, of course, not to travel abroad. So is that born from a kind of overreaction? I don't think so. I mean, I think when you look at this sort of ban, it evokes for me a couple of historical precedents. So one was the ban against Chinese immigrants, and the other one was the internment of Japanese, both of them based on ethnicity in those cases. We recall those as among the darkest chapters in American history. We recall those as times when we went off the tracks as a country. And we do it shamefully. I think this is very reminiscent of that.
You mentioned the SNHU community, and especially the international students and staff. Paul, what are you hearing from them? What situations are they dealing with?
So first thing we did is a survey to make sure that all the students from affected countries, because we do have students from some of the seven countries listed, are in the country and not outside, because our fear was that they would not get back in, even though they are here legally. So we were relieved to find out that they are here. Many of our students, and certainly alums and those who have gone on to get green cards, are very fretful about leaving the country. We're obviously advising them not to do so. And many of them had hoped to resettle family members, particularly from some of the war-torn regions. So a great deal of anxiety, as we read stories of people with green cards being coerced into signing those away and being sent back to their countries. These are the things that I think instill. So if you looked at the numbers, you might say, you know, in the end, it's not a large number, and I think it's less about the number and more about the precedent. Is this a signaling of a fundamental shift in the way that this country views people from other places? And we've, our legacy is built on welcoming refugees and immigrants to this country. I immigrated to this country, by the way.
From where?
From Canada. My family immigrated when I was a kid, and I became a citizen on the one-year anniversary of 9/11.
I did not know that. You learn something new every day, Paul. you talked about your international students and staff. You're advising them, look, just don't go anywhere right now. I glean from your letter that you also seem to be offering psychological help. I mean, just help with anxiety.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see this in the news stories. I think there's a front page picture of the Boston Globe today of Attorney General Maura Healey comforting two students, you know, and wearing hijab. So there's a great deal of anxiety and concern. So we're doing that. We're also offering immigration legal services that we will pay for as a university. And we're also our legal counsel exploring what our rights are as a private institution around compliance with enforcement efforts. So we'll obviously comply with any legal demand, but you know, if ICE agents wanted to come onto campus, what are our rights under those circumstances?
So would you require ICE, being the immigration agency, would you require ICE to get a search warrant before they could come on your campus, Paul?
It's precisely the question that we seek, and if we discovered that that was within our rights, we would do so.
Okay.
We're also not voluntarily releasing numbers of affected students and staff. Again, if we're legally compelled to do so, we obviously will comply with the law.
Paul LeBlanc, good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Laura.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. That's Paul LeBlanc. Again, he's president of Southern New Hampshire University. Very strongly worded letter on this to his campus community. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email that just came in from Pat, and I'll throw this to you, Aaron. Pat says, I find it extremely disingenuous, the remarks by Senator Shaheen regarding Iraqi persons who have assisted the military. There are specific exemptions in the executive order for such cases. Pat says, I personally have severe concerns about the president and many of his ideas, but if opposition continues to be purely partisan and inflammatory, the reasonable voices of dissent will be lost in the sensationalist or even violent divisiveness. Now, again, you are a law professor, not a politician, but you did reference earlier just a lot of confusion around this.
Right. And I think pointing to the Iraqi interpreters is a good way to demonstrate some of this confusion. So Pat is correct that the executive order also provides the ability on a case-by-case basis to waive the ban. But how that is going to be executed or implemented on the ground is where the confusion was created. So at JFK Airport on Saturday, two Iraqi men were en route to the United States when the executive order was signed. One of them was traveling on that special immigrant visa that Senator Shaheen mentioned. The other was someone
special,
who—
Sorry to interrupt, but special because he helped the military.
He was an engineer and an interpreter for the U.S. military and a contractor. And he was determined that his life was in danger because of his relationship with the U.S. military.
Sure.
So overseas, that determination was made. He was given the visa. He was en route to JFK Airport, along with another Iraqi man who was also had relationships with the U.S. military, and his family had been targeted and was coming as a refugee to follow to join his family. They were both apprehended and detained in New York, and it was only through a lawsuit that was filed by several different organizations and law schools that resulted in a federal judge on Saturday evening determining that they should not be sent back to Iraq. And so although that case-by-case exemption existed in the executive order, it was not utilized by the Customs and Border Protection officers, and it took a federal lawsuit to actually make sure that they were not sent back to Iraq on Saturday evening.
Well, that's another area where I'm a little confused, because you do have these federal judges, you know, weighing in this instance that you mentioned. So does their, I know we talked about this a little bit earlier, but does their say, I hate to use the word Trump, but does there say Trump, President Trump's executive order in those instances?
Well, and so what we refer to as the stay, again, is temporary. It's only, and it's not, doesn't deal with the validity or the constitutionality of the underlying executive orders. It just puts a pause on the ability for the immigration to remove those individuals. And the writing of the judge was she was concerned that the irreparable harm that those two men would face if returned because they might have been killed.
And so if that's a federal district judge in the New York area,
yes,
does that apply everywhere or just to that region?
The way that the order was written, it's a nationwide injunction.
Okay. Let's go back to our listeners. And Karen's in Brentwood. Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, Karen.
I am more concerned about the fact that the president fired the acting attorney general. As an attorney, you take an oath to follow the law. And when Karen Yates was in her Senate confirmation hearings to be acting attorney general, it was actually Senator Jeff Sessions who asked her, if a president asked you to do something that was illegal or unconstitutional, what would you do? And she said she would follow the law. So the fact that the president now would fire his acting attorney general, who in her belief is following the law, I find that deeply troubling. Not to say I don't find the executive order troubling. I do. But when you take that on top of the fact that he would fire someone who disagrees with him and is following her oath as an attorney, I find that deeply troubling.
Well, Karen, thank you for the call. And it's Sally Yates. But I know you had something that you wanted to add in on this firing. It was big news this morning.
Well, I mean, I think she was serving as the acting attorney general, but as acting attorney general, she serves at the pleasure of the president. And so while it might be disturbing politically for people, he absolutely, under the appointments clause and interpretations by courts, has the authority to tell her that she's no longer serving him. And so what he did, although might be troubling to people from a rule of law perspective, is well within his authority.
And this is what happens in the federal government. A new person comes in, the political appointees go out. So as the reporting has said, I think Sally Yates was on her way out anyway.
That's correct. She was planning to give her resignation as soon as Senator Jeff Sessions is confirmed. I believe there's talk that the vote might be today. And so she knew she was not going to be there any longer. But she made the decision for the reasons that the caller mentioned, that she felt compelled to issue that letter to the president.
Well, we've talked a lot about the specific cases. You know, again, the Iraqis who really helped the Americans during the Iraq War are really taking on the fight against ISIS. We talked about other specific cases like Reza's family that's been waiting for a decade, going through all the right hoops and standing in line and following the rules. Here's an email from Matt in Vermont who says, while I have sympathy for people caught in limbo, Matt says, public policy can't be made on a case-by-case basis. Matt, thank you for the email. And this is part of the immigration problem too, isn't it, Aaron, that, you know, we have broad policy, but then we have so many people who have so many different stories.
Right. And I think it's part of why there is a lot of discretion in immigration law. There's a recognition that there are individual circumstances that might merit a favorable act of discretion. But I think that that's true with a lot of different areas of the law. As you implement policy and you see it go down, oftentimes well-intentioned people creating policy don't understand how it's going to affect people on the ground when it's actually being implemented. And there sometimes needs to be corrective action that's taken given individual circumstances. But generally speaking, our laws are also informed about individual circumstances on the ground, which is sometimes why we have laws, right? So when something happens, lawmakers want to fix that problem. So I think that's a back and forth that we see in law and public policy. The individual cases do matter. But there's also we want to have consistent laws that apply across the board.
Matt, thank you for the email. Just a couple last questions for you, please, Aaron. There are a fair number of foreign students at UNH Law. We talked earlier to Paul LeBlanc at Southern Hampshire University, who talked about his international community. What are you hearing from the international students and staff at UNH Law?
I mean, I think just like he mentioned, just a broad anxiety, a broad fear about what might be next, might other countries might be added. Currently, all of our students, our semester started a lot earlier, so all of the students are in the building, they're here, they're studying. But I think very concerned about what this means. Undergraduate students at UNH, some of them are from those countries that are covered by the executive order. Will I be able to go home and see my family? Will my family be able to come to graduation? What are the next steps? Again, a lot of anxiety because of so much uncertainty, and also sort of the haphazard way this executive order has been implemented over the past couple of days, I think only heightens that anxiety because of the uncertainty.
Some people who are upset about this, Aaron, are calling it a, quote, constitutional crisis. Do you think it's a constitutional crisis or more a political event, and a very heated political event, but more a political event than a constitutional crisis?
I mean, I think it is, generally speaking, more of a political event, although I do think there are some examples that we've seen, like the two Iraqi men, where there are constitutional concerns about them because they're already present in the United States and they might have some procedural due process rights. But I do think, generally speaking, immigration is much more of an issue and a topic that has been understood by the courts to be best left up to the political branches, and it's generally a political question, which I guess is why people are coming to the streets, because they want to be and have their voices heard about what their positions are on this issue.
Well, Aaron, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
That's Aaron Corcoran. Again, she's a professor at UNH School of Law. She specializes in immigration. Our show today is part of NPR and NHPR's effort to look at the first 100 days of the White House and the State House. Now, the conversation always continues on Facebook and at nhpr.org. So if you didn't get a chance to jump in today, go on over to Facebook and continue the conversation there. The Exchange is also on Instagram at NHPR Exchange. Check it out for some fun behind-the-scenes pictures of what we're up to. Again, that's NHPR Exchange. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.